Yeah, so this is George Thomas on May 17th, 2012 for the big open data session of the Ontolog Forum. Thanks very much to Peter for his usual heroic organizational skills that are on display here, bringing together such an exciting group of panelists in their expert briefings. Really looking forward to what everyone has to say, given that we have so many exciting things going on, such as the 500 million node knowledge graph announcement yesterday from Google, and the fact that everybody on the panel today is working and somehow at the intersection of linked data and big data. So with that, I can, I guess, pass the baton to my other co-chairs, Jesse.
Hi, this is Jesse. I'm really glad to be here. And again, thank you, Peter, very much for organizing this session. I think we've got a great list of speakers and great content. I'm looking forward to hearing everyone speaking.
On slide two, we have all the speakers and their talks. I'm not going to read them out. But after all the presentations, we will have a panel discussion during which time Gene Holm, Chris Musilek, and Andrew Nicklin from last week's panel will be joining the panel. So we'll have a 20-minute or so panel discussion first before we open the floor up to everyone who's participating. And we're going to have another 20 minutes on that, or maybe a little more if we're lucky. I go on to slide number three. That's essentially what I already just said. So if we get to the slides and pull up the data says one, that's Joel's slides. So over to you, Joel.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks once again for this. We have a very busy schedule today, so I'll just get down right to it. Last week we gave a brief overview of what we did with NYC Facets, but now we'll look under the hood a bit and see what exactly we did and how we harvested all this metadata, extra metadata, and what's this thing we call cloud knowing. So briefly, if you go to slide two, that is Ontodia. Basically, we're trying to do the semantic web in our own little way, but the way we look at it is we're trying to create collective knowledge systems, but it's done, you know, by humans, facilitated by machines, facilitated and accelerated by machines. And we're doing it right now. We chose to start with smart cities. If you go to slide three, it just so happens that we're fortunate that we live in this part of the world and that in New York City, they have this big open data vision, and they've been aggressively pushing for open data. And this past year, they exposed, I guess taking a hint similar to what data.gov did, is they adopted Socrata, which gave us an easier way to make sense of all the data that the city was exposing. Just some history, the year before that, we did participate in Big Apps 2.0, but at that time, the city exposed about 300 data sets, and it was mostly CSV files, Excel files, and access files sitting on a web server. So this was a quantum leap from Big Apps 2. We did win at Big Apps 2. We partnered with Reveletics and Spry, and we came up with NYC Data Web. We won the Large Organization Award. And then when Big Apps 3 was announced last October, my co-founder and I, Sammy, we decided to make the jump, and we created NYC Facets. Just going to slide four. So once again, this is basically our tagline, cloud knowing, human-powered, machine-accelerated collective knowledge systems. And what we want to do is create that feedback loop, that conversation, and that virtuous cycle to refine and create this knowledge. And with NYC Facets, if you go to slide five, we created a semantic data dictionary. Just some background, once again, when we started Ontodia last October, in response to the NYC Big Apps 3 challenge. Our original vision was to create a data-backed wiki, an NYCpedia of sorts. That was our original ambition when we started doing Big Apps. But then we realized about a month and a half into the effort that that was really a tall order. So we decided, you know, we're scratching the itch because we were trying to catalog and understand all the metadata and characterize all the data sets. We were thinking, okay, we're not the only ones asking this question. You know, any developer or consultant will start with trying to understand the data. And we participated in several meetups, and that was a recurring question. So we said, let's scratch this itch, and let's do this pit stop first and do NYC facets. So we basically created the semantic data dictionary, and if you go to slide 6, it's not your typical data dictionary. We call it it's on semantic steroids. So we leverage a lot of the work of the community, specifically the Semantic Media Wiki community and Project Halo, and we enabled all kinds of features, you know, like that everybody who does semantic web and are familiar with it, faceted search, drill down, querying all the metadata, and also displaying and visualizing all that metadata. So actually, I think we went overboard. Right now, we have about 3.5 million facts, about 950 data sets that the city exposed. So I think we went overboard because we cataloged a lot of data apart from your traditional metadata. So if you go to slide 7, so just a quick overview of what we do. So on a weekly basis, we created this spider, which crawls the open data catalog that the New York City exposed through the RESTful API, that's for the API that Socrata has. And then that spider then extracts all the metadata it can using that API. And then we derive additional metadata, which is what we call exometadata. It's a term that we coin. And then we use the same, another API using Semantic MediaWiki and Project Halo stuff and MediaWiki API to pump all that metadata and extra metadata into NYC facets. So going to slide 8. So in a typical data dictionary for everybody here who's done any application design and development, typical data dictionary, you expect to see a lot of these things, you know, what's the name of the data set, the category, who owns it, owner ID, the column names, the data type of the column names, etc. So we did all that and exposed it on NYC facets. And if you go to slide 9, you'll see a quick screenshot of that. But we went a bit further. So apart from just creating the data dictionary, the semantic steroid stuff that we did, if we derived and computed additional metadata that was not exposed by the API. And basically, we were trying to characterize each data set, not just by describing the schema, but also underlying and sampling the data as well. For those people who have built data warehouses, you know, this is something that you should be familiar to you. But beyond that, we took another step, is we tried scoring each data set, similar to Google PageRank. So we scored it along different axes and attributes like freshness, uniqueness, sparseness, you know, the social activity, how many people are downloading this data set, how many people are viewing this data set, and then we created that compound score called BDSP's rank, which is on a scale of 1 to 10 or 0 to 10. The whole idea behind this is we want to give signal to everybody using the data. A signal to the publisher that, hey, maybe you need to update the data because your score is going down. A signal to the end user, to the regular citizen that, okay, this data may be suspect because it hasn't been updated in a while. And a signal to the developer who's using these data sets to say, okay, this is something, you know, apart, maybe you should use this other data set apart, and if this data set is suspect. So we want to create that conversation and micro conversation and contributions around the data. Let's quite quickly on page 11 what Excel metadata we compiled. Surprisingly, the number of rows for each data set was not exposed to the SODA API, so we computed that. And then, like I described, the Audacity's rank, we compiled using all these attributes, freshness, sparseness, social, views, download rating. But one thing that's different with the Audacity's rank, it's still not fully exposed, but the intent there is to keep it open, to keep the computation transparent. So, you know, unlike some scoring algorithms there that are somewhat opaque and they just give you general guidelines on how, say, Google Panda works, they don't really give you how it's computed. They just give you some general guidelines on how to do it, and basically you do trial and error. We plan to expose how we compute each attribute for Audacity's rank. So then people will know with confidence, okay, it's not fresh, or because there's no social activity, that's why my rank is this high or this low. And for the reason why we have so many triples in our system right now is we also sampled each data set and got the top values for each column. So, and then on top of that, we also extracted several simple descriptive statistics, like how many values are null, non-null, the smallest value, the largest value, and the quote-unquote the uniqueness of the values inside that column. And why would that be useful? Say I'm looking at, on the next screen, page 12. Here is a screenshot of me looking at the Wi-Fi hotspot location data set. And just by quickly looking at NYC facets and clicking on name, I can get a sense of what's the data like without downloading that multi-gigabyte file. Right, so here I can see, okay, the number one hotspot location is Starbucks, and McDonald's is number 3 and 4, and we see a data quality issue there. We hopefully will address that automatically too in the future. So then you can see without really downloading the data, and this is good for developers, okay, there's some data quality issues that I have to be aware of, and here's the distribution. Say I want to build an app just for Brooklyn. I can look at the zip code, I can look at the borough section and see that, okay, this has information about Brooklyn. So if we go to slide 13, we also characterize the uniqueness of each data set. So we can see here, again, looking at the same data set, Wi-Fi hotspot location, that even though they have phone type and URL in the data set, it's empty. They don't have any values in those columns. So once again, that's a good hint. So it's much more than a data dictionary because we also correlate it with the underlying data. Finally, let's go to slide 14. So we said crowd knowing, right? And we have in the crowd in one hand of that loop and the machine on the other. So we also want to capture some micro-conversations and contributions. So in its current state, we're only capturing the number of views, the number of downloads, the comments, the overall rating. We do have bug reports, but we haven't exposed that yet, and the likes and shares. And that also gets factored into the score. Ultimately, we want to get – these are all secondary and tertiary signals – we want to enable micro-contributions as well. And we're tracking, and I'm sure everybody's aware of the Wikidata project. So we want to get people to contribute to the data set. So use the crowd to improve the quality of the data and have that conversation with the publisher. So that's something that we want to work on in the future. So if we skip to slide 16, this is, well, when the detail for GitHub 3 was only so much, but we can stand up in about 2 months. So for the future of NYC Facets, we'll incorporate more data sources, not just the NYC Open Data Catalog, and we will also allow the ability to query not just the metadata, but the underlying data as well and do federated queries. And we'll have an API, but it's a standards-based API. which is for everybody here, a Sparkle endpoint, and some other things. We should be announcing some things in Semtech. We'll be at Semtech next month as to who we're partnering with to enable all these things. So our vision is in time for Big Apps 4.0 around October of this year. We'll be in a position to offer the next generation NYC Fastest platform to the Big Apps 4 developers. That's it. Thank you. Peter?
Jesse, want to introduce our speakers?
Okay, I can do that.
Oh, please.
So thank you, Joe, for the really informational talk. I'm Jesse. As you know, I'm the general chair of the conference SNWCon Sprint 2012, and that is in San Diego, Carlsbad, actually. It was a great conference. We have several talks, you know, that's really related to the big open data. Joe was there too, and the following three speakers: Will Smith, Stephen Larson, and John Weirs. They will be talking about different aspects of the SNWCon. So the first is Will Smith. He will give us a general overview of linked data integration framework. Will?
Hello. All right, let's get this started. So I do want to point out while we're on the intro slide that I am not the main development engineer behind this. I am the main application user of this, and I'm standing in for Christian. I'm only bringing this up because on questions at the end, I may not be able to answer them all, but I can certainly find you the answers to questions. So let's move on to the next slide. Linked data challenges. Joel brought up two really good pieces during his talk. One of them was that he found 3.5 million facts, and some of them were empty and some of them were inconsistent. And the other one is that he had 900-plus data sets. LinkedIf, LDIF, is actually an attempt to normalize these vocabularies, collect all this data, and then also add a rating system from the data set to the data that we're collecting as a way to tier the trustworthiness of certain sources. So with these linked data challenges, as we all know, we've pretty much created a couple thousand different APIs for our particular vocabularies and languages. This has caused trouble. It's made it very difficult with a wide range of vocabularies to come to any kind of standard, even using the RDF namespace. We have different identifiers for the same real-world entities. We'll be discussing that and how that is fixed with Silk. And we also have a lot of conflicting values for the same property. What is one? Living in the U.S., most of our city names directly come from European city names. So it's really hard to target which entity and which set of corresponding triples are actually the same across data sets. And that is what LDIF tries to do, and it actually does it pretty well. Next slide, please. And it does this through this simple pipeline. It takes our multiple data sources. It tries to clean these representations, and it tries to rate the data coming in. It uses the 1-5 pipeline listed here. We will be discussing that throughout the next five slides in quite a bit of detail. It is open source, of course. It is written in Java. And it was built between a collaboration at the Free University of Berlin and a Vulcan subcontractor named MES Semantics. That is Christian's group, and he is the active maintainer. Next, please. This is one of the more standard slides, pipeline collection. We support RDF dumps. I contacted Christian hoping to get a list of all of the various formats we can ingest. I did not get one back yet. I have tested it in Turtle, in Triples, and some standard RDFA formats, and it's been working okay. It can also read from Sparkle endpoints, and it can also crawl linked data. Crawling linked data on its own does require some specialized formats for the bots that will be used, but that is expected when crawling and ripping pages. Next slide. And this gets into the real meat of where the pipeline starts. We start with an R2R translator. The whole point of R2R and the first step is to normalize vocabulary into a central vocabulary. So as you can see here, we have DBpedia, a Scheme, and a Facebook namespaces. And all of these attempt to map these existing vocabularies into a central vocabulary we'll be using for our broadcast. The mappings are expressed in Turtle. These complex mappings do have Sparkle expressivity, so if you need to use a Sparkle query to find an exceptionally deep point in an RDF dump, you can do that and map that to your current vocabulary. And there's transformation functions as well. Next slide. And then we resolve identities. This is what happens when we have lots of RDF triple sets that have conflicting label names. Here, it takes Berlin, Germany, and matches those together by using the latitude and longitude. We use this for several gene naming conventions using different IDs. There's one called the exergens ID, which is usually pretty good at mapping genes, even if they have horribly different labels. And this will create a mapping between two sets of triples coming in from different data sets. These are expressed in XML, and there's also the same transformation and comparison in comparators. Next slide. And finally, cleansing data. This is the newest component we have added, called Sieve. It actually takes a ranking as the user denotes. These configuration files can get pretty big. But what it allows the user to do is actually prefer one data set over the other. So in this example, two data sets are reporting Berlin's population, but one is about 100,000 people in the wrong direction. Using these star tags, he has set up a comparator to say that he prefers the bottom data set with 3.5 million over the other one. And that creates a conglomerated one while keeping providence of where the 3.5 million came from. This, again, is an XML configuration file. See, you can create some of the bigger ones just because with so many data sets coming in and so many arguments about which data should be collected, these can get pretty specific. And finally, next slide. The output. I have seen it output in triples and a Sparkle update stream. The Sparkle update stream was recently added. It also puts providence tracking out in the form of a named graph. So you'll be able to go to your data set and not only update your triple store directly or generate the files, but you'll also have a secondary file with a listing of all the transformations, all the normalizations, where it came from, who was chosen. And this is actually very helpful for debugging. And in the neuroscience and science communities, the people that care about these data sets and look over the data have a strong preference for certain ones over the other, and it really matters to them where something came from. So it's a secondary piece of backup information. And the next slide. And this is the entirety of the architecture. The bottom two tiers we all know and are familiar of, the publication layer and the web of data. And the third tier is really where LDIF sits in. You'll see that it actually looks onto the web of data, does its translation process, and builds one endpoint for an application. This is extremely important, and I think that it's one of those tools that's going to hit the mainstream pretty quickly. Next slide. And to aid the adoption process, we've actually got three different versions of it. Currently, we use an in-memory one to map six different biology data sets, and that created about 63,000 entities that were collapsed into one store. That's the RAM target. This is a very big machine, and it takes it about 7 hours. As far as the RDF store and TDB, we use those for development machines. They can run for a long while, but they can also start almost immediately without having to repopulate every time. As said, though, this is absolutely not scalable and really isn't recommended for anything beyond development and small sets of data or test sets, which I use them for. And then the Hadoop setting. This is where Joel would need to come in with his 900 sets and 3.5 million facts. This can be scaled up. We've tested it on AWS to like 18 Hadoop nodes, and it ran in a reasonable amount of time. Next slide. Thank you. This is an active project. You have a website and a Google group. The engineers and developers at MES will also be at SimTech next month and would love to talk. I believe they also have a speech about that. This is developed in conjunction with Jesse and I's project here at Vulcan, Project Halo. It also has EU funding. That is where the Free University of Berlin comes in and maintains the page and projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. So I think we'll keep the questions later. Next speaker will be Steve Larson, talking about neuroscience information framework.
Great. Everybody hear me all right?
Yes.
Great. Thanks, everyone. I'm honored to get a chance to chat with this group. I'm going to be talking to you about a project I did in my PhD in neuroscience. I'm originally a hacker like the rest of you, but I made the jump into biology, and there's quite a few hairy knowledge representation challenges here that that I think this world of linked data can apply to. So next slide. So the reason that things are exciting right now, and kind of the reason that neuroscience is hard, is trying to be captured here in this slide, which basically says that there's information across different levels of spatial scale that neuroscientists have to cope with. And there's essentially neuroscientists working at every scale in a box that you see here. In the bottom right corner, there's molecules and trying to understand how individual molecules work in the context of cells in the brain. Going a step up for parts, pieces and parts of cells, there are people who study just one little piece of a neuron, like a spine. Moving a step up beyond that, people who study the shapes of cells, you know, and the way that it, the shape of a neuron affects the way that it it communicates with others. Above that, the way that cells group together into populations and circuits. So things that can be seen with light microscopy images. That's what the LM stands for. EM is electron microscopy. Up above that, the way that those sort of circuits form into, you know, large conglomerations and sort of what we call the gross anatomy. And then even above that, you know, what you can see in terms of the whole structure. So what this really amounts to is a really hairy problem. Next slide, please. Really hairy problem for knowledge representation and for linked data. What we really would like to have in neuroscience, but we don't have, is something that looks more like this, the periodic table, where you've got all the entities that we want to worry about in the brain all kind of organized with respect to each other. So we want to have all the molecules nicely put into the parts of cells that they belong, and we want to have those parts of cells nicely organized into the cells. So we kind of want to have this, like, the most complex sort of Russian doll kind of set up where everything is really in its place. And we really don't have that in neuroscience. So this is the target. Next slide, please. The reason we want that is because there's scientific progress can be made when you start aggregating across scale. This is a picture of Watson and Crick, who discovered the structure of the double helix. And this is a picture where they literally physically built a model of the double helix, right? And in order to do that, they had to combine knowledge about atoms and the way that they bond together in the molecules and the bond angles. The way they aggregate in the molecules and the way those molecules can aggregate into a macromolecule of the double helix. And they did that by knowing enough about the different pieces of scale and being able to organize that together. Now, the challenge for the nervous system, we think, is many orders of magnitude more complex than this, and this is why the physical model no longer works, and we're kind of left with doing things like building graph models inside of databases. Next slide, please. So I'm basically going to be talking about how we organize knowledge in terms of words and terminology, so that things that will be published in journal articles that have that describe relationships between entities inside neuroscience, or the what of neuroscience. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So in the past, we've been building up semantic models now for a while, and there's a history of building up semantic models of neuroscience. This is an example of a model that crosses scales. Where at the top, we have calbindin, which is the type of molecule that's related to neurons. Below that, we have some of the pieces of cell that they're related to, like the axon of a cerebellum Purkinje cell. Those tie in together to a concept of a Purkinje neuron. Below that, in the yellow, we have areas of brain that those pieces are related to. Next slide, please. So that's a sort of a simple semantic network. And, you know, in order to really capture the complexity of the brain, we have to scale that out many orders. This is an example of grouping together just some of the varieties of neurons that exist in a simple ISA hierarchy. And this is work that I did early on in my graduate career, and this was implemented in OWL, RDF OWL. And we were making these ontologies using the protege system, and we started doing it as individuals, and we started to run into some challenges that I'll go into in a moment. Next slide, please. So once you start to aggregate these, you know, these knowledge structures together, you can start doing some things like doing some very simplistic reasoning. Okay, so on the left-hand side here, we have a simple list of neurons. On the right-hand side, we've done some inference using OWL-VL constructs in order to group the neurons on the left into categories that, you know, that were defined by their properties rather than asserted directly. So this is about the simplest thing that you can imagine in, you know, in terms of what OWL can do. But in the field of neuroscience, this is actually something that is, you know, once you go beyond a very simple list of 10 to 12 neurons and you start to get into, you know, a couple hundred, this starts to become a lot more interesting because it's still not well defined what are the classes of neurons inside neuroscience. Next slide, please. Okay, so we were doing this stuff in OWL. And next slide, please. And we kind of needed to go beyond that. And so now I'm going to take a step to a different, I'm going to come at this from a different angle. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Neuroscience Information Framework, which is a project funded by the NIH Blueprint. And basically the challenge here was that NIH has been funding databases for information related to neuroscience for, you know, 20, 30 years. About as long as databases have been around, people have been wanting to put data about the brain into databases. So the Neuroscience Information Framework is now in its fourth year, and its basic mission is to find all those databases out there and aggregate them together and put a single search engine on top of that. So sort of the Google for these neuroscience databases. But the reason that Google doesn't do this already by itself is because it doesn't tend to index into database rows, you know, because that isn't exposed to the public web. So NIF has been doing that work. Next slide, please. And it's aggregated quite a lot of resources already. This is a snapshot of places around the world of databases that have been put into it. Next slide, please. So some examples of this, so now we're on slide 13. So this is a list of the top 25 databases that have been accessed through NIF over the last, in the last month, right? I think this is the month of March. So you can kind of get an overview here of some of those. The Allen Institute is in there, grants.gov, people look for grants. People looking for antibodies is something that's relevant. Those are molecules that bind to other molecules that are used very frequently in neuroscience experiments. And some people search for computational models, genes, et cetera. So this really spans a wide gamut of different resources and different types of data that people in neuroscience want to find. Keep going, please. Next slide, 14. Okay, so now kind of coming back to, you know, organizing the information in neuroscience. So back in 2009, the Society for Neuroscience meeting, that was the largest annual meeting, 30,000 neuroscientists get together and talk about their data. There was recognized that there really wasn't a parts list for the brain that, you know, was represented anything more than sort of atlases and free text. So what might be in a parts list for the brain, you want to certainly have brain regions broken down into their subregions. You want to know what cells are in those brain regions. You want to know what projections are coming in. So essentially, there was this call for the kind of semantic model that we were starting to build and that I showed earlier as one of my first slides. Next slide, please. So as part of the Neuroscience Information Framework, in order to kind of bring some regularity and consistency to how we were aggregating information across all those databases, we said to ourselves, well, you know, this whole thing of editing an ontology and how it doesn't scale so well. So is there a way that we can kind of crowdsource or at least manage in a more collaborative way the definition of these kinds of semantic models? So we formed the NeuroLex to do that. It's built on top of Semantic Media Wiki. And we started it out by populating it from this large aggregated OWL ontology that we had been building up over time. That OWL ontology itself is an aggregate of many other ontologies that preceded it. These are the kinds of ontologies that you'd find on bioportal.org, which is another project also funded by the NIH. So we put it in there, originally populated it, and that was at the end of, I think, 2009, and it's been aggregating to the point where now it has about 18,000 concepts, and I think at last count something like 1.3 million triples. Next slide, please. So this is an example of a page when you're editing a cell. We make use of semantic forms, a really nice extension, so that you're not just editing free wiki text, but you're actually presented with a form. And this lets us do nice things like do autocompletes from other parts of the wiki, so that when you're defining you're defining the semantic model, you're not just defining that in free text, you know that you're choosing from a list of entities that also exist inside the wiki, and this is a very nice way to create additional interlinkages between these data, because these data really need to be concatenated and collaborated and aggregated into a whole. Next slide, please. So when you make use of the wiki environment and you add a fact and that creates a cross-linkage, obviously one of the advantages of this that we make use of is that there's a lot of other pages that get automatically updated behind the scenes because they're being driven by queries rather than, you know, being a bunch of static text that's on there. So the nice thing about the Semantic Media Wiki is that because you say that a particular cell has got a particular kind of molecule associated with it, it shows up on a list of all cells that have that kind of molecule, and it shows up on a list of which brain region it's part of. And so we're really making use of the facility here of Semantic Media Wiki, and this is and my lower left-hand corner icon there is just to show you that this is a similar process to what we had been doing in OWL. We're now kind of doing it, although not, you know, making full use of the DL terminology, we're able to do a fairly good job of putting this information out through the wiki pages. Next slide, please. And this is just a quick snapshot of all the kinds of entities that we have in there. The largest chunk of the pie is for resources, so databases like the ones that we were showing you before. Those have been put into the wiki themselves, and they've been marked up with information about the kind of data that they have in there that are also drawn from knowledge from the wiki. So when we say that this particular source has MRI images, then it's linked to the concept of MRI images. So we have a marked up semantic notion of what is in these resources. Next slide, please. A lot of the content there is searched well by Google, and so about 80% of our traffic comes in from search engines. Next slide, please. And that means that about a large fraction of our pages actually come up in the first 10 results on Google. So we get so if you search for terms like next slide, please, like cholinergic neuron, that shows up near the top. Actually, I just searched it just now, and I think it's fallen down to like 8th or something, but about 6,000 of our pages show up on the first 10 results of Google when you search for it, which really I think is great because it shows that there is a need and a demand that we're kind of filling in on Google where it can't find, you know, better ranked results than what we're, you know, what we're putting out. And so we think that means that that's better because people don't have to find Neuralex directly. They don't have to know about it in advance. They can Google for it, and we sort of can provide that information to them indirectly, and they can discover the rest of the holdings that are there. Next slide, please. Okay, this is a graph that summarizes what we know about neurons. The green here is where we know, where we have knowledge, and the red is where we don't have knowledge. So advance two more slides, please, just to get kind of into the meat of this. So to zoom in on what that's showing, and then one more, so we get to slide, I think, go back one. I think it didn't update quickly. Yeah, slide 24 is where I want to be. This is just sort of saying, like, to get closer to a periodic table, I generated this as an interesting thought that we could perhaps, you know, boil down what we do know about neurons to something that is at least in a tabular form so that we can see how much uncertainty we have. So that table, there was a lot of red in it. It's about 33% filled in. When you look in at what those different pieces are, you see that the rows are, each row is an individual neuron, and in the columns you have properties that we might like to know about them, like where is the cell body located, you know, in what region is it located, or what is the neurotransmitter that it uses, or does it have, you know, spines? That's a feature that neurons have or they don't have. So what we've done is, to the best of our knowledge, we find about 290 neurons that anyone's ever written anything about, and to the best of our knowledge, we've been able to fill in as much as we know about it to about a 33% level. We think that this, you know, obviously this isn't complete, but what we think is this represents a target that when this is 100% filled out, or if we get to 80% filled out, we'll actually have a lot more that's consolidated in a way that, you know, all this then gets exported out into RDF and it can be mined, you know, for the future, for any kind of future questions that you might like to ask about it. So we really think that we're, you know, trying to push forward and make some clarity in neuroscience where there really hasn't been as much before. Next slide, please. Okay, and this is jointly managed by the Neuroscience Information Framework and another group called the INCF. They've been appointing expert curators at this, so we actually do have neuroscientists editing this, as well as curators who will fix any problems with the content when somebody submits, you know, something that spam or whatever, And also the curators know enough about the domain so that if somebody puts, you know, a new bit of knowledge in there, they know enough to, you know, reach out to other experts and ask them if this is really true or not. So there is some quality control on it. But it does have anyone able to edit it at the moment, so anybody can come in and make a change. Last slide. Okay, so I went really quickly through that, but I think I close-ish to time. So I just wanted to wrap up. So what I did today is I described to you some work to represent neuroscience using ontologies, talked about the multi-scale problem, and introduce you to Neuroscience Information Framework and NeuroLife.org, which is the semantic wiki part of the Neuroscience Information Framework and how we're creating structured data in neuroscience. And I showed you in the last table there the ways that we're using that structured data to kind of outline and map out what the landscape looks like in neuroscience in a better way, in a more structured way than just sort of free text. NIF is something that's run by a lot of people. There's a list of folks there. Marianne Martone at UCSD is the director of it. It's something I've been contributing to for quite a while, and also special thanks to the folks at Vulcan who've been helping us take our Semantic Media Wiki version, upgrade it. The Elvis stuff that, that Will just talked about is something that we're about to be making great use of, and we're really excited about that. So sorry for running a little bit over time. Thanks very much, everybody, for listening.
Thank you very much, Stefan, for this good, very informational talk. Next presentation will be John. John is the dev lead in the OpenAI project. The original speaker, Ryan McKeer, couldn't make it, but we got more you know, senior people here. John, please. Hello.
Bernadette's presentation actually might be a bit related to what was just presented by Stephen. So maybe, George, you want to introduce Bernadette, and let's move Bernadette's presentation up.
Sure. Happy to introduce Bernadette, my co-chair in the W3C Government Linked Data Working Group and a well-known person in linked data community here who's doing a lot of work with open government data and linked data for government agencies, and I think she's going to present some other work she's doing that is in government and industry. Bernadette?
Hi. I promise to speak somewhat more slowly than some of the other speakers because I don't have access to my IV drip of Red Bull. That was amazing. Thank you, Stephen, and the other speakers. I tried to trim down a presentation that I recently gave at a conference that I attended at EPA in Research Triangle Park in North Carolina last week, and the topic of that discussion was, or that workshop with about 200 human health and environmental scientists, was on the issue of how to better integrate multi-scale models and data for that community, the human health and environmental science community. And they had a number of plenary and sector perspectives from federal, industry, private sector, and academe and an NGO segment as well. And I would say that what was interesting to me was that a number of people hadn't heard of RDF and linked data, that they have tremendous depth of expertise in their given subdomain, and they have been working for many years and have very, very distinguished bios in many cases and are working on very, very important and compelling projects. But they don't know how to share that information. If we could go to slide 2 in my presentation. the problem statement was for this workshop, and I'm going to basically cover what I covered in a considerably longer presentation and then 2 days of workshop face-to-face meetings, was how do we harness these large and increasingly complex data sets to examine the potential of ecological impacts. For example, the BP oil spill, how quickly will the oil spread to beaches where human beings are, or impact our fisheries. And these are important things that contribute to human health and illness and toxicity and risk assessment. And I think for many years I personally was talking about the importance of connecting disparate data sources, but it was really, really driven home to me about the risks and challenges that in a certainly increasingly flat, hot, and crowded world, we, to quote a famous author, Tom Friedman, we really have to drive a lot of the work, for example, that George and I are doing at the W3 Government Linked Data Working Group by these use cases. Next slide. The need to integrate and manage these large amounts of data in a rigorous and transparent manner, as Stefan suggested in the previous discussion, neuroscientists want to make sure that they're dealing with people, trusted peers, if they're taking this information, that they understand the provenance of the information. And they most of all need to be able to collaborate on information, which in many cases they'll describe a model. We had many discussions, many hours of discussions about what is a model. Could be an equation, could be a spreadsheet, could be a database, could be a set of comma separated value content. So it's not necessarily the way the linked data community or the semantic technologies community more broadly describes model, but from a scientific perspective. But overall, what they're doing is trying to share data sets, for lack of a better word, via the web. Not all the data necessarily will be made available to the web or expressed as data in the web or data on the web. Next slide, slide number four. And so the topic of, and the reason that I was invited, and I think George was invited to this conference, was to talk about a better way to connect data. And the supposition or position that I'm coming from is to do so using international data exchange standards, specifically the RDF family of standards. And what's really quite remarkable about the set of data standards driven out of the work of largely standards bodies, including IETF, W3, OGC, OMG, a lot of standards bodies, is to be able to express data, use vocabularies, and express the data so it can be interoperated on or used interoperably. And the more we can get reuse out of these data sets, the quicker we can advance science. And importantly, what I really got from this workshop last week was there are scientists who are spending tens and tens of millions of dollars worth of grant funding in the United States and Europe and elsewhere. And unless these scientists, many of whom, as was pointed out, are 50 years old or older, pick up the phone or potentially send an email because they know the community and they know who the experts are in their field, there's no really good way for them to share the information or what I would describe as the metadata about their models and their data. That's pretty interesting. I think that that really is a great use case that can drive a lot of our work. Next slide. So what I'm going to be addressing briefly today is data interoperability and interlinking around the 4 or 5-star linked data model. So if anybody on the call has not, or listening to this talk, has not familiar with the linked data 5-star model that Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, described a couple of years ago, there's a graphic here, and I'll just very briefly go over it. 1-star means you've made information in an open license format on the web. That's good. That's a good first start. And a lot of government content in the broader data.gov, and I say that broadly, not all the individual countries that have open transparency government portal sites. But a lot of the data that's available today is 1-star data. 2-star data is machine-readable data. 3-star is making it available in a non-proprietary format. The vast majority of the open government content is available as PDF. And what our days are focused on is making data available using compliant to the RDF standards and ideally making it a highly interlinked data set. Probably the communities that are most advanced in terms of making data available in 4- and 5-star format are the healthcare life sciences and the Intel community behind firewalls. I think next slide, number 6, the web is very different. The web is the web of data that some people have already referred to is different again and has very large ramifications in terms of interoperability. And the fact that we now are beginning to see tools to handle data, tools such as Semantic Media Wiki, another tool that I'll talk to a little bit later called Columacus, that allows us to leverage a universal client, the web browser, and be able to handle things like URL curation and interconnect these data sets published in an RDF, in RDF, the international standard, is very, very powerful. Next slide, which is slide number 7. What we see happening, and we have been in this, working in the field with RDF since around 1999, before it was a standard, is that finally in 2012, we're beginning to see much more structured data on the web, and I would say that we're in the early phase of mainstream adoption. We're working with a number of U.S. government federal agencies who are beginning to publish data. They have to go through a learning curve and socializing it within the management team because it's yet another task on their to-do list, and they need to understand what it means from what resources are required, are there contractors and subcontractors that they can work with in order to make this happen, what are security implications. Then at the same time, in parallel, a lot of movement to hosting things out on the cloud is happening. So companies such as ours are going through the process of working with some of the big infrastructure as a service providers on the cloud that have that are compliant with FISMA to enable us to be able to publish or agencies to publish their data on a FISMA compliant, suitably FISMA compliant cloud service provider. This year we're seeing more apps challenges, hackathons, the continuation of hackathons, but some real funding for contractors and research organizations. You know, there was a big announcement recently out of the White House for $200 million worth of funding. I think that's a lot of that will be DARPA-related funding. Next slide. Number 8. This is just a slide that I often use in presentations to describe who is using and who is publishing linked data. Europeana in Europe has a tremendous amount of content through NASA, and NASA, of course, was one of the earliest contributors and has done a tremendous amount with ontology-driven data management and for obvious reasons. Perhaps Gene will talk about that a little bit later. Next slide, number 9. For anybody who is unfamiliar with what we're talking about when we talk about linked data, I like to show this slide, machine-readable content that you can see beneath the more beautifully depicted, although I actually didn't show you the beautiful BBC page with the mallard duck on it. But this is what RDF looks like under the covers. There's emphasis on using or reuse of commonly used vocabularies to better make the data more interoperable. So there's, you know, RDF and SCOS and Dublin Core listed at the top there. But that same data set that contains the data as well as the model within the RDF data set can, if looked at by a web browser, present a nice human-readable representation of the page. Many people are, I'm sure, familiar with this. Next slide, number 10. To help managers get this who may have not previously been familiar with RDF, I always point to the credit card example. It has human-readable information on the front side and machine-readable information on the back. Next slide, 11. So this was this is always an important thing because people who are into RDF and more broadly linked data and semantic technologies all think it's great and we all love the technology, but I think it's often important to step back and say why is it important and you know, who's using it. And so in a shorter presentation, I'm not showing you a couple of slides that I have that just show how ubiquitous RDF or RDFA structured data on the web has become, but it suffice to say many, many new media, many, many old media, retailers, healthcare, life science communities, et cetera, are all publishing structured data in the form of RDF, RDFA on the web. You know, people talk about which serialization is best. It's, in my opinion, irrelevant. As long as you have it in one of the RDF serializations, it can be automatically converted into another. And it is absolutely, without question, the future of using the web. It's not to say that it's perfect. You know, there's lots of active work going on in various standards organizations to refine vocabularies. It's continuing to mature. but the standards are absolutely mature enough. In fact, they're far in advance of many of the standards that I used to use within the corporate community in the financial services industry 15 years ago. Next slide. So one of the things I described to the scientific community last week was in terms of introducing the concept of publishing data or metadata about their models and their data in RDF format is to use RDF just to publish the metadata. That's good. That's a good first step. What's better, potentially, is to publish all of your data. It doesn't necessarily have to be linked open data, so I always like to highlight the difference between linked open data and linked data. Linked data all the techniques that I think we're talking about on this call today can be used behind a firewall. And but for the government, largely, they're talking about open government, so publishing in a linked open data, using linked data principles out on the public web is probably the focus of most of what we're talking about. And ideally, to link all of your data and models using a linked data approach is the best thing. So finding some of your data that interlinks with vocabularies that your industry or subdomain uses is the ideal way to go. Next slide, number 13. I want to just give a real quick example. A lot of us for many years talked about this in the abstract sense or from the perspective of advanced research, because that's certainly where in the first decade of semantic technologies money came from, was the research community, or to the research community, I should say. And now it's very much being seen as the future of the web by healthcare life sciences, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies, et cetera. Centara is a Virginia regional healthcare provider. Next slide. They're looking at the use of open government data, the broader linked data cloud with DBpedia, PubMed, NLM data, with internal anonymized EMR data, electronic medical records data. And they're looking at this opportunity to, they're describing the opportunities to their executive management team as a better, smarter, far more agile, less expensive way to do business intelligence. Next slide. The value proposition of a proof of concept that we're working on with them is to decrease the cost of very expensive readmits to the emergency room and improve patients' ability to care better for themselves, to be proactive about taking their medications, to be aware potentially of, in this particular proof of concepts case, air quality. And that data is published by a government agency, go figure, the US EPA. Next slide, this is slide number 16. So we are developing have developed a proof of concept that we'll be showing at the upcoming HDI forum. That's the Health Data Initiative Forum. It's the third year it's been running. It's going to be in D.C. Perhaps George can talk to that a little bit more. He's very involved in that event. But the idea is that we are trying to demonstrate how government data combined with private sector, in this case they're a nonprofit company data, can be used for overall social, public welfare benefit or public good and public health. Next slide. The way we did this, we did it in 60 days for a relatively small amount of money, was we used an open source tool called Columacus. Columacus is a linked data management platform. It has been developed in large part by several engineers from companies that I have worked with over the last several years, Talus, Zafira, and Three Round Stones. And it's a platform that allows the user to take full advantage of RDF and data-driven navigation. So it was designed with Web 2.0 developers in mind, but the development effort was very much led by several very, very smart people in the area of semantic technologies, including Dr. David Wood and James Lee and several people in the UK. It's ideal for creating registries and data portals so that governments can provide citizens access to open government data. Corporations are using it to provide internal workflows and annotation services for editors, also to provide timely information to the public, customers, suppliers, regulators, et cetera, and can be certainly used for research portals. Here's a quick example. Next slide. this is slide number 18 and shows a screenshot of the Centara proof of concept. On the left-hand side, it pulls in open government content from EPA on the air quality. And in the middle, it provides some general information off the web through links to better health. Connects them to a nurse or a wellness hotline, and this is all available as well as a web app. So that's really what that information's meant. And then on the right-hand column has information that's the anonymized EMR data for a given individual. So if this were my data, and it's not, it can remind me potentially of when I had trips to the emergency room or the urgent care facility, and I can click on that and drill down. Next slide, 19, to more details. This view is a view of a given asthma patient that presumably a physician would see, and it has the patient history encircled in red there. It has the air quality index for the Hampton Roads, Virginia area, and correlates the visits to the emergency room to the air quality to see if there's any correlation. Next slide. To point out to the community that this is not any longer in the phase of doctoral research, that large vendors, including IBM and Oracle, have made very public announcements, most recently IBM about a month and a half ago, for native RDF support in DB2. Oracle, of course, for the last 5 years has had a RDF support. It's largely used in their geospatial component. It's certainly not I don't know Oracle's the nuances of Oracle's business model, but I would say heretofore it hasn't been central to Oracle's revenue stream, but I think it is increasingly is seen to be increasingly central to the large vendors, relational database vendors, and business intelligence and enterprise information integration vendors. Core revenue, and all the way through small companies like ours, Three Round Stones. We're a specialist in linked data, and so I provide there a link on slide number 20 to a list of active projects, companies, and research happening around linked data. If you are actively involved in this field and you want to be added, please go to that link and read the instructions, and we can send you. It's a deliverable from the Government Linked Data Working Group, we'd certainly like to have you add your information about your project or your company or the projects that you're working on in that community directory, and we hope it will evolve. It's, of course, completely based on RDF-based technology, as you would expect, and all of the data is available as RDF for people to repurpose. And just if people are interested, we've got best practices and some vocabularies available for first public working draft. Next slide, 21. There's some information on the Kalamakis platform for data-driven applications. Next slide, 22, the charter and the URL for the Government Linked Data Working Group that George and I are involved with. If you are interested, we would love to have feedback on some of the things that we are publishing in first public working draft this year. We're slated to go for 2 years. We are about halfway done with our charter. And final slide, 23. This happened to be a list of recommendations, and if people want to discuss it later, that might be useful, that I left my presentation on with the scientific community in terms of specific recommendations they can begin to adopt. Again, people like Stefan are just light years ahead of where much of the scientific community is, only in the extent that they're doing something and have a tool to be able to share the data and discuss the data that they're working on. I think that the solution is well known from a technology perspective to allow this brain trust of very brilliant scientists in private and public sector to be able to better share information. And I hope events like this will help kind of cast the net a bit further and help them cross that last, I would call it perhaps 10% of the distance to be able to really do some meaningful scientific research on human health and the well-being of our environment. So that is my talk. If anybody, I guess we're holding all questions till later. So look forward to speaking to you. I am over.
Oh, thank you, Bernadette. Let's check. Is John Weirs online now? Jesse?
I don't think he's online. He probably had something can't really show up today.
All right.
Just give him this.
Okay, then maybe we move on. But before we do that, I noticed there are about 8 to 10 people on the voice call who is not on the chat. So if you have internet access, refresh your session page at the top. There's a link that gets you into our chat board. You need to be in there for the moderators to know that you're in the session. When we come to the discussion, then you will need to show your hand before you can get engaged there. Right? I guess we move on to the next presentation, which is a presentation that a few colleagues of mine, Mike Dean, Leo Oberst, and Ken Slosky from the OOR team, the Open Ontology Repository team, who's going to talk about the OOR effort and how we could leverage that effort in big open data. Bring up the slides. If we move to slide number 2, essentially this is what we're going to talk about. I mean, the four of us sharing a 10-minute slot, so we might speak fairly quickly, but I will essentially just introduce the team, and then Leo will tell us about ontology as an imperative for big data. Mike tells us more about the OOR initiative and how could people find a good ontology. And then Ken will take over from there and make a proposition on how one could implement big open data in government through open collaboration with what we're doing in the Open Ontology Repository efforts. Before I move over, I would say this is not the first time we talk about it. In fact, I would say every time I have a chance to talk to people, I try to get them to help move semantics and ontology into the mainstream because it is important and it is one way to really get us out of the current mind into the next level of computational capabilities. These were an excerpt from the recommendations that Pat Hayes, Mark Musin, and I sent in when we were invited to comment on the PCAST NITERT report. I would not read them out, but essentially we started mentioning that the Open Ontology Repository could play a role, for example, in some of the things that we just talked about, electronic health records, in research, and in supporting government open data. So moving over to Leo.
Slide 4. Yes, hi, folks. As you're probably aware, we just finished our Ontology Summit 2012 season with a two-day symposium at NIST on April 12th and 13th. But the 3 months was actually a virtual discourse on ontologies for big systems. We had just about 500 people participating, ontologists, systems architects, systems engineers, and really big data and big systems stakeholders. It spanned 28 virtual sessions with 99 presentations, many panels, briefings, and 1,300 messages on the distribution list dedicated to the summit. What we did basically was finalize it by distilling the results of our discussions into a 10-page communique. And of course, one primary conclusion we've drawn is that really ontologies and ontological analysis are required if you're going to really truly address architecting and engineering big systems, which of course need big data. Basically, our current engineering practices and tools break down, are not scalable without some sort of semantic technologies to assist us. Next slide is 5. The ontology imperative. What we believe in, really, and OOR and other activities that we participate in, including one that's not yet mentioned, which is ongoing, which is a NSF-funded EarthCube for really big geoscience, geosemantics of geoscience. But the ontology imperative, what we want to do is make explicit and accessible all the implicit but yet required and vital assumptions about structuring and functions of engineered systems and their components. We want to help people better understand, disentangle the complexity of the big engineered systems, and of course that requires the social, economic, and legal environmental complex surrounding these systems and systems of systems. We of course want to enable integration among systems and data and large data through semantic interoperability. Ontologies allow humans really to delegate much more to the machines. So we talk about machine interpretability, machine semantic interpretability. So the machines assist the humans. They come up to us as opposed to we going down into the weeds of data and components of systems. Of course, it improves models and modeling, enabling, you know, much quicker and general adaptability and reuse. It reduces development operational costs and obviously maintenance costs over time. Obviously, again, it enhances decision support systems, providing assistance in search knowledge management, discovery, and giving us really a basis for extensive and extendable adaptable systems. Next up will be Mike Dean, talk a little more about the OOR.
Thanks, Leo. Peter, can you advance to slide 6?
Yes.
So the OOR project started in 2008. It was actually the main topic of Ontology Summit 2008. And we really emerged from that with 3 primary goals. The first is to develop a set of modular open source software for registries and repositories, a goal of standing up at least one instance of that, and you'll see the list of instances that we have, partial list of the instances on the next slide, and also really to identify the best practices for ontology sharing and management. So the software is intended basically to and being architected basically to support a number of choices along a number of technical and non-technical dimensions. So I'll let you read that list, but won't read it to you. So moving on to slide 7. This is basically the current family of OOR repositories. BioPortal, which was mentioned earlier, is really an amazing example of a domain-specific ontology repository that is supporting a large and very active community. SOCOP is a newer addition in the spatial and geospatial realm that's actually being funded by an NSF grant. several other efforts at, with the marine metadata and some of the work that's going on at Oak Ridge, again, our other domain-specific instances. Kalari is a repository for common logic that's being developed by Michael Gruninger's group at the University of Toronto. OntoHub is a European effort that is focused on distributed ontologies and translation between different ontology representations. The last three here are basically different development and testing instances that the OOR initiative itself maintains. And I'd like to now turn it over to Ken.
Hi. You know, as you can see, there's some ambitious goals that the OOR would like to achieve. And some of the techniques that we're using in order to tackle these objectives are that we're supporting an evolutionary development process. We are using techniques such as web services to make sure that the OOR will be scalable. An important aspect of this is to make sure that the OOR supports federation, allowing individuals to use ontologies from a variety of sources through one of the OOR instances. And considerable relevance to this meeting is to provide services that are decoupled from the core functionality, in other words, having a kind of plug-in or extension mechanism that we are now working on, and in particular, we would like to have integration with these important tools such as Semantic Media Wiki. The intention is that the OOR will be very general in terms of supporting ontology languages of a variety of sorts. One aspect of modern data is that it's still predominantly stored in relational databases, and so we do need to support the kinds of relational database schemas that are out there, but to enhance them, of course, as has been mentioned in a number of our talks, to make them data sources within a linked data environment. The OOR itself is intended to be developed in an ontologically driven manner, and we're building it to be platform independent. Going to the next slide, slide 9, this is an immense problem dealing with hundreds of thousands of data sets. Just how would one go about doing this? We've seen a lot of excellent projects that have developed tools for this. In the OOR, we, of course, don't want to stop just at the data schema or just vocabulary. We want to identify ontologies that will be useful for linking these together. Examples are upper and superdomain ontologies, and I'll list a number of examples there of upper ontologies that have been used in the ontology community as well as in government. And a new one, ICOM, which is a ontology now in development and standardization for collaborative work environments and social networking, which could certainly be an important aspect of the kinds of work we're talking about. Then, of course, you would expect to be, you would need to be able to develop new domain ontologies and to host those ontologies on the OOR for dealing with this kind of integration. And what this means is that you have to map the schemas and data sources to these various domain, superdomain, and upper ontologies. Of course, you want to nurture the communities to try to sustain this effort with the crowd-knowing techniques that that we have seen proposed and have been used in a number of these projects successfully. However, you want to maintain individuals who act as gatekeepers and curators, and so you need to have workflows and policies for ensuring quality of the ontologies and the mappings. So I would like now to move to slide 10 and Peter.
Okay. So what are the next steps? Actually, if we look closely, all the panelists this week and last week, ourselves included and those who spoke before us, have a lot in common. What we are doing is we are developing infrastructure with really huge potential impacts. And we are creating technology, but not just technology. We are trying to harness content. We are building trusted social networks, which could create unprecedented value. One thing, as we covered when we talked about big system, was that, I mean, big system includes big data, includes smart system, but it also includes heterogeneous or complex system. By complex, an easy definition is no single person or no single group can actually manage it all. This is hard work. Someone has to do it. And actually, there's no shortcuts to doing it well or doing it right. So I guess what we could do is to team up, collaborate, and leverage each other's strengths and expertise. So let's create the communities and the ecosystems and allow those communities to thrive. During the open discussion, one thing Gene and George and Jesse and I were talking about when we said we were going to, what we're going to do after these two sessions is, I mean, how can we move the whole thing forward? So that's all I have. I've got a few references, and that ends our presentation. So maybe one more time, let's check if John is online. If not, then let's move to George. Do you want to maybe coordinate some discussion among the panelists, especially Gene and Chris and Andrew, who are returning from last week?
Well, if by coordinate you mean open it up and encourage Gene and Chris and Andrew to express some of their reactions to what they've seen and heard today, then yes, by all means. Gene?
Great. So, again, just always completely energized and enthusiastic about the kinds of work that people were presenting today. Bernadette's work with Three Round Stones I'm very familiar with because she's got such a great leadership role with the W3C, and the work that her company is doing has made a big difference, especially in healthcare. But was really interested to see the work on some of the neuroscience and other areas, and it was nice seeing these things starting to really mature. It just makes me want to find out better ways of coordinating all of these activities from a federal sector. And so I just kind of want to open that as a way. And Joel and I are already working with sort of the NYP stuff with the city.data.gov, and anything we can do to try to help organize these efforts or make them actually integrated into things like data.gov or vocab.data.gov, I think would just be really great.
Yeah, and this is George again, so I would echo Gene's sentiments with regard to healthdata.gov. Stephen, it's always amazing to be exposed to yet another amazing body of work that is somehow related to HHS or NIH in the case of the work that you're doing. And so there are certainly community opportunities around healthdata.gov as well. And just want to once again give a shout out to the Linked Data Integration Framework folks. Will, thanks very much for that presentation. I spend a good bit of my time turning people on to what's going on with LDIF and the tools there. Other thoughts? Chris, are you online? Looks like Bernadette has raised her hand.
Is it Stefan or Stephen Larson?
Stephen.
Stephen, I would really benefit from hearing some of the kind of how your project came to be, what the player, you know, who the players were, not so much by name but roles, and how you evaluated tools and brought a community together. Because sometimes just hearing how somebody else did it, you know, triggers an idea inside of somebody else's head. And also I think sometimes it's humbling to realize I often hear our customers say to us, or the people we work with are not necessarily our customers, people we work with say, you know, we're just doing this proof of concept because we want to understand what's involved, what type of people and background skill sets are needed, et cetera. And they almost feel somewhat embarrassed by saying that. And I'm like, that's what everybody's doing. It's okay. You know, everybody needs to get familiar with this new paradigm and demonstrate with their own idea, with their own data, what it looks like, what tools are around, what books are around, how to socialize it with their executive management team, et cetera. So I would really welcome your describing how it worked for you, because you've obviously made great progress and have a lot of, you know, prestigious people, you know, backing you.
Oh, thanks very much. I really appreciate it. I'm going to post in the chat right now a link to get, you know, a more complete answer to this. So I will say that Marianne Martone is really the thought leader behind the Neuroscience Information Framework, and she's the principal investigator on Neuroscience Information Framework. But as a overview, it's a project of the NIH Blueprint for Neuroscience Research, and I think that its initial intention, as I mentioned briefly, was that the NIH realized that it didn't have a sort of a central way for itself to keep track of all of its database resources that it had been funding, so that it would know, you know, in the future what grants to give out and which ones to refer people to put their data in an existing repository. So that very practical goal was one of the core missions of the Neuroscience Information Framework. And where semantics came into it is that the contract, because really it's an NIH contract, not a grant, that was given for this was done in a interdisciplinary way. So we have folks from the San Diego Supercomputer Center here at UCSD who work with us, and that's the way in which some of these linked data technologies came along, so that it wasn't just it wasn't an effort that was just about database alignment. So, and Marianne is very much in the ontology community as well. She and I have published papers in the past on ontologies for neuroscience, and you know, we've worked with Mark Meese in the past, and so the BioPortal community. So we all know each other in this community. But I think that the role that linked data and semantics have played in this is really driven by the core challenge of how do you take, you know, all the databases that the NIH has funded for neuroscience research and put it together in a way that makes sense, because you have columns in one database that you know, were built under a schema that had one intention in mind, and you got columns in another one, and it may have the same entities or similar entities, but it's been built in a completely different schema. So we felt that this work that we're doing with Neuralex is really the best way for us to get the community to help us with the challenge of defining a semantic graph, semantic network, or an ontology, if you will, that could drive that process of reconciliation between all these databases, which suffer from the problems of multi-schema, but multi-scale. So it was really driven by that challenge, that practical challenge, and it was because of the people that were at the table, you know, the folks from the semantic web community at the San Diego Supercomputer Center, Amarnath Gupta at the San Diego Supercomputer Center is one of those as well, that really helped to drive this forward. So did I basically answer your question there?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Very helpful.
Okay. I noticed John Weirs is on the voice bridge now. John, can you say hello?
Hey, everyone.
Great. We missed you just now, so maybe we could go to your presentation. You really have to move quickly, though. Is that okay?
Sure. Let me just pull it open.
Bring up
your
slides, and I guess everyone can bring up John's slides. It's labeled 4 Weirs.
Great. Sounds like I have. Sorry for popping in last minute. I had a prior engagement that I couldn't get out of. But I'm glad I'm here now and have an opportunity to present. So I'll go through these pretty quick. Hopefully you've got my slides open, starting on the title, Opening EI, Energy Information. Just wanted to showcase some of the linked open data success stories we've had the pleasure of doing recently. It's been a lot of fun. Moving on to slide number 2, just a quick impact and overview of the Linked Open Data Project. OpenEI is a free and open knowledge sharing platform created to facilitate access to energy-related data models, tools, and information. It's spun out of the open government and has been pretty successful. We've had a lot of recognition. We've been featured on the White House Innovations Gallery. Jumping to the statistics in the middle of slide 2, over 800 data sets, over 56,000 content pages on OpenEI. It's quite a beast. We've got over 17 million RDF triples in our triple store, and just all kinds of open, free, data, energy related. Moving on to slide three. It's not just a triple store. Obviously, since we're part of this talk, we are built on Semantic Media Wiki, but there's also a lot of other aspects to OpenAI, so I like to often refer to it as a platform of platforms. We've got a big data sets component built out of Drupal and using Amazon S3 data storage, and we've also got an app section built on Simile Exhibit and a community section that we're trying to launch. It's in beta right now, but it's going to be built on Drupal Commons and just tying a bunch of these things together and really trying to make it as seamless of a user experience as possible. And, of course, we are on the Amazon Cloud, which is pretty unusual in the .gov arena. That's where the reason we're openai.org. It gives us a little bit more freedom to do some things like that. And the Amazon Cloud has been very good to us, allowing us to grow and scale at a very acceptable rate. So moving on to slide four. This is more or less a table of contents of the rest of my presentation, so I'm not going to read these to you. Just suffice it to say, I'm going to show off some of the more fun projects we've done in the last year or so on OpenAI. So without further ado, slide five. Going to talk about Regal integration. If you're not familiar with Regal, it's a fantastic company, really fun to work with. They're basically the renewable energy Google. The company itself is actually REAP with three E's, and they're based in Vienna, Austria. They do a lot of linked open data as it pertains to countries and renewable energy, and they have fantastic APIs on their thesaurus. They have a big block of terms on renewable energy concepts and topics. And also they do policy and regulatory overviews. So one of the things we have on OpenAI is a country profile for each country in the world. And we import all kinds of semantic data to help us populate that so that we at NREL can just focus on the things we're good at, you know, the typical semantic data mantra. Import that which you do not wish to maintain, like population and GDP, and focus on the stuff you're good at, like energy maps and solar and wind resource potential for countries around the world. And supplementary content, like descriptions and population figures, we're pulling in from DBpedia. And, of course, the policy and regulatory overview you see there, we're pulling from Regal's Sparkle Endpoint, and marrying that all together using the same DBpedia dereferenced URI in the form of a FOF page property that we use on the OpenAI page for our country pages. So it's really easy for us to just ping DBpedia and Regal and say, hey, we're talking about this. Please give us all the information you have on it. And then we incorporate it. Moving on to slide six. This is one I'm particularly really excited about. Geothermal has had several projects recently, their regulatory roadmap and their exploration database, which they have decided to put into the wiki. And this is one of the first times we've actually taken a project from the ground up and decided in the initial planning phase that the ideal database for this project is actually Semantic Media Wiki. And so that's a pretty new concept for me. Usually in my experience, it's been taking something out of a spreadsheet or MySQL and putting it into the triple store and converting it. This from the ground up, we decided was best suited in a linked open data format. And the example of these concepts, you can really see how location-specific information flows naturally up in scale from individual sites through areas and regions to countries and so on. And individual techniques flow naturally from categories all the way down to their techniques. But what's really interesting and the reason we took this approach is activities are a mashup of source material, which is basically references, citations, nothing new in the semantic world. And these concepts of geothermal areas and exploration techniques combined together, it becomes a geothermal exploration activity. And this is the real reason we decided to take this approach for this project. And that's because the initial prototype was developed in Access, and they often had requests for, hey, can you look up how many activities were done in this region that employed this technique that were successful that ended up turning into a fully developed power plant? And then the very next day, the question might be, hey, of all the power plants in Nevada, how many of them use the same method for detecting resource potential that was used in this county in California? And so same information, but coming at it from completely unique angles, almost every request. What happened right off the bat was the geothermal developers had to write custom SQL queries for just about every request. And so putting this all into a semantic framework has empowered our geothermal team, who's not necessarily that tech savvy, to just write a few ask queries and jump through the semantic wiki and start creating mashups of their own data. And they really love it. It was presented at Stanford a few months ago and was very well received. So that's been pretty fun. Moving on to slide 7. The OpenEI utility rate database. We have over 3,600 utility rates, and they're stored in a full resolution and complexity. That image you see there with all the different numbers and colors and grids is the more complex utility rate schedules we have. Without going into too much detail about it, many of you may be familiar with this, but some of you, if you're fortunate enough, live in an area where you just have a single utility rate. So you probably have no idea what we're talking about. Just to recap really quick, utility rates in some areas, like parts of Texas or California, can change by time of day, by load, by month of the year. And so you may be paying a different rate for electricity usage per hour at noon today than you would be at 8 a.m. today or noon tomorrow. So mapping this is really important because it provides added value to a lot of models and simulations out there that currently just use an aggregate average of utility rates over the whole year, which is completely unrespective in some areas. In some areas it works fine, but in some areas not so well. So putting this all together, making it available in linked open data, RDF JSON, even CSV downloads, even a RESTful API, just trying to get it out there as many ways as possible has been a big success. It's being used by Desire. Many people are familiar with Desire. They might not realize that OpenEI is the underlying database for them. And also a lot of internal apps and widgets like the Solar Advisor model at NREL or INBI. And then those, of course, have APIs as well and feed their results out to external sites and industry. And Sun Edison's using this database, and it's getting a lot of traction lately, so that's been pretty fun. It is crowdsourced data, too. There's an army of interns somewhere implementing things as part of a data collection effort, but there's also just a big campaign to get utilities to volunteer that information. And I'm going to go ahead and move on to slide 8. This is just another integration we did with Regal and Wikipedia, pulling stuff from DBpedia. On OpenEI, we have a glossary of terms, and pretty straightforward. We have our definition. We're supplementing that content with other definitions. But this has actually been very well received. Our users like it a lot because the multiple sources of information and the ability to make their own informed discoveries about something, not just definitions, but other things. And a lot of traction picking up on this, actually, because of Regal's new API on semantic term extraction. It's in its beta phase right now. They hope to make it open to the public soon. OpenEI is one of the beta testers of that API. And what it does is you can pass it any block of text, and it mines text for common terms based off your previous submissions and also based off Regal's thesaurus, and returns those to you with semantic links to the thesaurus concepts. And so at the bottom of that screenshot, you see the related terms there. Those are actually being supplemented by Regal's API. So we can collect our definition, combine it with a Wikipedia definition for a little extra context, send it to Regal. We get back Regal's definition and a series of related terms that link to terms in our database. And it's pretty slick. There's a lot of potential for that. We're exploring the possibility of a recommendation engine based off it, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of, hey, you read this wiki page, you might also be interested in this other wiki page. So it should be pretty fun. And last but not least, slide 9. I had to include this one because it's always surprising to me. Sometimes the simplest implementation of Semantic Media Wiki is the best. We have a map of wind farms. A concept of wind power generation facilities exists on OpenAI, and part of that concept is the collection of coordinates for each wind farm, and we just throw them out on a map, and all that is semantic forms and the semantic result format for Google Maps, and that's it, and it's one of our most popular pages. We also output that in CSV, and it's downloaded hundreds of times a day. So pretty surprising that the public appreciates that a lot more than I ever thought they would. And last slide, slide 10, just want to thanks. Sorry I rushed through that. And these slides are obviously available online, so feel free to read through them again at your own pace. And contact me if you have any questions.
Thank you, John. We are in the middle of the discussion. We were discussing among the panel just now. Maybe this is a good opportunity to move over to the open Q&A and discussion. So I know we don't have a lot of time. So for those who are familiar with the process, this is time to click on the hand button in the chat room, which is at your lower right corner of the chat window. And let's queue people up for Q&A and discussions. Let's take Bill Nadell's question or remarks. Bill, star 7.
Hey, that was a terrific presentation, so I want to thank you, everybody. It's very informative. My question is, can anyone see their usage of business rules, either using SWRL or the rule interchange format, in any of their projects or in any of their frameworks? Where do you see this, and is it your addressing? Thank you.
Kind of difficult if we don't know who specifically we're trying to address, but maybe for those who presented today, does any one of you use SWRL?
Peter?
Yes.
Peter, this is Ken?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, in the work we're doing on the OR, we have been using business rules, workflows. We don't use RIF. We pretty much are sticking to Sparkle endpoints for inference, although, you know, the hope is that eventually we'll have the possibility to have a plug-in module for doing inference. But at the moment, we're just sticking to relatively simple techniques for inference. Does anyone else have a comment on that?
Yeah, I actually would direct Bill. I don't know if you're familiar with the Ontolog body of knowledge. I mean, we've collected over the years many good presentations, and among them, for example, Chris Welty made the first RIF presentation on Ontolog. If you go to the Ontolog Wiki home page and just search for RIF, or SWRL that Martin O'Connor at Stanford has been working on, I actually host the wiki, Protégé Wiki, where Martin's work is hosted. And Martin has, I think, presented about SWRL at least in two different locations, maybe even more. So again, search on that front page and look for Swirl or Martin O'Connor, and you probably land on a good body of knowledge there.
This is Mike Dean. We use Swirl extensively as well, particularly for executable mappings between ontologies.
This is Wheel. We've translated Swirl into logic programming. So we use ontologies plus rules, but then we do our reasoning in logic programming for a number of different projects.
This is Stephen Larson. We experimented with Swirl in the sort of the past section when I spoke about our work with OWL, and we do continue to maintain an OWL ontology. However, because one of our challenges is bridging the knowledge holdings that we have out to biologists who are not particularly eager to write rules or comfortable with that, we mainly do anything that you would do in Swirl, the kind of reasoning. We do that in Semantic Media Wiki ask queries that are hidden behind a page so that our end users who are neuroscientists don't have to worry about constructing those themselves. They're just built into pages.
Hope that answers your question, Bill. While nobody else has their hand up, as I mentioned, Peter Yim again, I mentioned before, one of the things we wanted to find out is this group interested in moving forward? I mean, after these two sessions, George and Jean and Jesse and I started out saying, well, let's do two sessions and see what happens. So two sessions are almost done. What does the group think? I mean, is this topic interesting enough that we want to move forward? I want to hear some comments and ideas.
Hi, Peter. This is Bernadette. I would say that it's great, and I certainly learned a lot listening to some other presentations. Any outreach that could be done to bring, in the spirit of more interdisciplinary groups that have very compelling use cases, to use this technology would be welcome. So there are a lot of people on this call whose names I recognize who already are drinking Kool-Aid around, semantic technologies, but bringing new people to this and potentially targeting it at either a quite detailed developer audience or an executive audience or whatever the defined audience is would be useful. But one of the things I work on is getting collateral that's sufficiently comprehensive to give presentations to CXOs in government. And on the other hand, best practices and documentation on standardized vocabularies or recommended vocabularies that are consistent and have been peer-reviewed by a group of people who are very knowledgeable about this and using it in the world. So I think there's a real need for this kind of stuff, but the key thing is getting intermixing with people who have really compelling use cases and want to learn more.
Fantastic. Would you might repeat capturing it into the chat so that it becomes part of the proceedings?
Sure.
Then we can follow up from there. Before I take Bo's question, I know George Thomas has a hard deadline on 2:30. So, George, if you have a final remark before you leave us.
Yes, just wanted to say thanks again, Peter, and I just put into the chat for anyone that would like to follow up on with me directly. The Peter's bio page for me has how to contact me, and I certainly support any collaboration going forward. Continuing with Ontolog Forum and those of us involved with data.gov that are pursuing these related aspects. So thanks again, especially Peter, for making this happen. It was a great session, and unfortunately I'm going to have to jump off and run now. Thanks again, everybody.
Well, thank you very much, George, and thanks to everyone who has to drop off now. I know a lot of you have hard stops there. And for those who can stay a little bit, maybe we'll take another 5-10 minutes and finish up some discussion. But in whatever case, try to capture that onto the chat because, I mean, people actually do read that stuff and try to follow up. So, Bo?
Yes, very quickly. with all the work on federating and integrating and normalizing, my work is actually looking kind of the other way, and that is being able to deal with multi-perspective ontologies where I avoid any losses from reductionism. Anybody working in that area, or I've seen tremendous value in what's being done here and tremendous sources that I could possibly use, but anyone who has been working in the area of multi-perspective ontologies and that type of thing would like to get a hold of me, I'd love to hear it. I'll put my email address in the comments, and thank you very much, Peter, for a great session.
Thank you, Bo. Jesse, I know Jesse has to run too. You have maybe one final remark if you're still around.
Jesse is out, but I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
Will from Vulcan.
All right. Okay, Will. So,
as far as multi-ontology alignment or working with multiple ontologies, those are two things.
Peter?
Yes. Ravi?
We hear. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
I had a question for Bernadette. If she used some work that was done in connection with worldwidescience.org that's coming out of NRGRC people, or how are you going to take this example of this asthma case to a wider measurable economic return out of this development?
I heard your question in parts. You said, how are we going to take it out to a broader platform?
No, to make it measurable that it's economically effective or it does help. For example,
well, I'll tell you.
EPA
yeah.
data.
Everybody gets to that ROI question, whether it's government or industry. Actually, I think that the uptake of semantic technologies and many of the things described on this call today would be served by having a couple of seminal white papers or papers of some form, you know, peer-reviewed is better, certainly, around ROIs on a number of different projects, and preferably some from private sector, nonprofit, and public sector. And so I raised this up the flagpole to one community that I deal with, the W3, and Tim Berners-Lee was even on the phone, and he goes, yeah, I really agree, we need that. You know, would you be willing to put together an outline for that? So every time we ask for these things, it kind of gets lumped back on the shoulders of the person who did the asking. So
yeah.
I'm getting
yeah.
to be a little bit more gunshot yeah. about asking for these
yeah.
things. But I think that
collection of such, yeah.
Gene Holm could attest to this, that in the first open government forum 2 years ago, that the core question came back to what's the ROI. And so I think, you know, where a lot of these projects are is they've gotten research funding, they're proof of concepts, and I can assure you that I will be one of the first people who publishes something when we get approved numbers from those different sectors that I mentioned, but I'm actively trying to gather that and hope that we can get it reviewed by the public through the W3 and get it endorsed or effectively out on W3 letterhead, so to speak, because I think that would do an awful lot to help make the use case for smart researchers who know this is really valuable, but they're having a hard time getting any budget to take it further or to make it more mainstream. And those of you who talked about really cool projects that you've done, you know, good on you, but it's the exception. You know, we've got to make it. There's so much value to all the things people were talking about today and that many people have been talking about for a decade, but we need to get funding to be able to make it really go mainstream, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so the collection of such use cases, such examples, certainly would make up for a case. And such approach together might one day say, we got it enough. This direction requires more funding.
So may I ask who's asking the question?
Ravi Sharma. Dr.
Ravi
Sharma.
Ravi, do you have one you can contribute by any chance?
You mean an example?
Yeah. Are you working with these technologies? Have you deployed
working
them?
With this, but largely in DoD sector, but I will certainly think of an example.
So we wanted to contact, for example, Dennis Wisnowski before, I think he's retiring in DOD.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And ask him if he's able to put any hard numbers. So he was our DOD use case.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, Ravi. I'll try to reach out to you. I'll ask Peter for your contact.
Yes, I have my info on the wiki.
Thank you very much.
Charlie. Thanks.
Hey, this is John Weirs from NREL. Real quick comment for Bernadette. You mentioned earlier that it would be beneficial to have more of a high-level LOD broadcasting to potential people interested, and also possibly combined with this idea of focusing on ROI initiatives and stuff. I'm actually currently tasked with a follow-up presentation on a very similar thing that OpenAI did on in partnership with REAP in Abu Dhabi at the World Renewable Energy Forum last January. And we're looking to do an international event here in the States. And I'm interested to know if you would consider possibly participating or being on board with that, or maybe even helping coordinate such an effort where we can hopefully accomplish exactly what you were asking for.
Great. I have a email half drafted to you, and so I'll follow up with you. I was just asking you about Elaine, as a matter of fact.
Oh, excellent.
All right. We'll talk. Great. Thank you.
That's fantastic.
See, this community could really benefit from having regular phone calls with one another and telling each other what's going on.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
I agree.
So,
certainly.
Yeah. Is Jean still on the line? Since you're among one of those who pushed us into this, so maybe it's proper that maybe you do a wrap up. And then we can call it the day. Maybe she had a hard stop too. So seeing no hands up on the chat, I guess people are happy with what has transpired. I will take the opportunity to thank all the panelists, whether it's from this week or even from last week, for all their valuable contributions, for sharing their work and sharing their insights with us. Special thanks to Joel Natividad, who is among us that got the spotlight and got us into rallying these couple of sessions. So thanks, Joe, and congratulations again. And then thank you, everyone, for the participation, for joining us today and last Thursday, and for all the contributions. And on that note, that ends our May 17th virtual session, and goodbye. We will be posting, as usual, the audio recording, the chat transcripts, and so on. So check back in a couple of days if any one of you would like to revisit some of the details. Bye-bye. Thank you.